An extremely warm welcome to our four speakers today. It's a great honour to have you all here together in the same room. Probably it will never happen again because you're from all over the place and doing so many different things. I will introduce Dr. Christopher Stevens, who has passionately managed to combine a career in development, archaeology, gardening and cooking. Latterly in Mozambique, but he will tell you more about that. Caroline Herford, who heads up the United Nations World Food Programme in London, and prior to that, worked as a journalist with the BBC and also freelance with a number of newspapers. And then we have Carol Pearson from CDC Group, and that's the UK's Development Finance Institution, which is owned by the Department for International Development. And Hazel Douglas, who is Director of Oxford HR, an International Development Executive Search Consultancy. So without further ado, I will ask each of my speakers to talk for, if we could aim for 7 minutes, because then I will take questions at the end. So if we could kick off with Chris.
I'll do my best. If you can't hear me, I'll stand up, actually. Yeah, if you can't hear me, you let me know. First, it's good to be back at Oxford. I was here at St. John's many years ago. You guys wouldn't have been alive then, don't think for many of you. I did Oriental Studies and History. I also studied archaeology at Cambridge. International development as a field of study or as a field of work came rather latish for me and my work. Most of it was done in museums and heritage in Canada, in the Canadian circumpolar regions, Asia. I eventually ended up working in East Africa as a call from the German Development Agency because they needed expertise in park development, national and international park management, conservation of lands in conjunction with new irrigation projects. Food security and agriculture are key components of international development in East Africa. By East Africa, I'm talking about Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and the southern part. I call East Africa the whole coast of the African continent, as opposed to the political economic zone that people normally label as East Africa. I've been working in Mozambique for the last 7 years. I wrote a little piece in this careers bulletin. When you get the chance, you can read it. I have worked for the German Development Agency and the Irish, the Americans now, and the Canadians. So I work for some of the key players. We have 110 nations. We have over 200 NGOs working in Mozambique. Our bring-in budget for an economy that's on the poverty line is over $8.5 billion, which is being spent every year to shore up livelihoods. We're doing appallingly bad in food security. We're doing really, really good in health and education. Okay? In other words, the report card that goes in from Mozambique to the IMF, which bailed Mozambique out last year to the tune of a wretched amount of money on the case of price rises, mostly has to do with the difficulty of the government itself in its maturity or immaturity to be able to make it sufficiently clear to the international community what its priorities are. We're getting a little bit closer. We've realized that on a poverty reduction strategy that health and education are the key targets. At the Canadian hosting of the G8 in a place called Muskoka, look that up on your Google, you'll discover that maternal health is at the top of the agenda and that the commitment of $5.5 billion just to sub-Saharan Africa is at the key parts of the development agenda. So when we talk about maternal health, we're talking about women, mothers who are working. And since 80% of women working in Mozambique are women working on the land, you betcha, it's food security, it's bottom line. What more to tell you? What do on a day-to-day basis? I work, when I'm in Mozambique, I manage a huge project now, which is opening up a new river basin to agricultural and irrigation. That is family plots that are sustainable. We're developing new seed banks. We're helping with the creation of pediatric clinics to deal with mothers and issues of health concerning their children or their newborns. I work long days, wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, don't normally get to bed until after midnight. There's always crises. We've always got issues of people being quite sick. Death, starvation, malnutrition. We deal with it every day. I face it every day. I like what I do. I feel like when I'm working there, I have a life. I've worked in many other aspects of the UN in between the time that I worked in Mozambique and the time I started off here at Oxford. I worked for UNEP and UNICEF and UNDP, mostly in the office. I felt pretty good about writing reports. I feel a lot better about not writing reports. And maybe I can end up and say to you, we don't need more reports in Africa. We don't need more death studies. We don't need more agencies. We don't need more money spent on headquarter buildings in terms of development. What we need is we need people who have the heart and courage to stand their ground and come to Africa to work and who are prepared to stay with it. Not the in-and-out and consultant. If you're looking for a job, don't come to Southern Africa. If you're looking for a life, come. Thanks.
Thank you. Caroline Herford. I was not at Oxford. I was at Durham University, where I did Russian and English. And to be honest, I had no idea what I was going to do when I graduated. And in those days, back in the dim and distant mists of time, you didn't have to have a master's, basically. Whereas I'm afraid nowadays it looks very much as though your degree, your first degree, is almost like A-levels, and then you get a master's, or you go and do a master's because you can't find a job. This is the state of my son right now, who's just graduated from the LSE. Anyway, when I came out, it seemed like a good idea at the time to go and do a brief shorthand typing course, which I did while I was living at home in Bristol. And the poor woman who was dictating to us had to compete with the Concorde engines revving every now and again. But I came out of that with an ability to type, which of course is not a problem for you guys because you've grown up with PCs. So you don't even need to do that, although the shorthand can come in very useful, especially if you go and pursue a career in journalism. Well, going back to me, I, as I say, had absolutely no idea what I was going to do. One of my friends on that shorthand typing course urged me to go with her to Greece, where we joined a kind of hippie trail, and my parents were okay with that. But before I left, I was supposed to apply for a couple of jobs. So I applied for exactly that, a couple of jobs. Tate Gallery Research Assistant and BBC Caversham Monitoring Service. Guess what? I never heard from the Tate Gallery, and when I was out cruising the islands and thinking that, oh, this is heaven, you know, I'm going to be a tour guide or something for the next while, I phoned up my parents and said, any news? And they said, yes, come back to England. You've got an interview at the BBC. They were very excited, and I thought, yeah, I've heard all that before. It's really tough to get in, because a lot of my friends, of course, had either gone into publishing, which was the go-to career for graduates, and others had tried the BBC and tried newspapers. Blah. Anyway, I don't know if anybody knows about the monitoring service, but it's based at Caversham, just outside Reading. Bit of a backwater. I thought, I told myself when I was offered a job there, well, this is quite exciting because it's kind of spying. And with my Russian degree, I was excited about that. But fortunately, I wasn't supposed to listen to Radio Mayak every day because I think I'd have gone to sleep straight away. I was actually in the editorial section, which was basically pulling from those broadcast transcripts items that might or might not be interesting to the government, who is our chief client. Anyway, of course, once you're in an organization like that, you can get further in. But you still had to apply for what are called attachments, and I think they still are. And because I met my future husband there, he went to Bush House. I said, right, I'm not coming to Bush House. I'm going to Broadcasting House. So I joined the newsroom, which was radio news, basically writing the summaries and the bulletins and so on. That was great. Then I went to television. And then my husband got a job with Reuters out in Moscow. So that seemed sensible because we both speak Russian. And so I followed him out to Moscow, where I became a producer with Brian Hanrahan, the late Brian Hanrahan, who I worked with, who was a great guy, taught me a lot. And then, it's slightly complicated this, but we left Moscow after 4 years, came back to London because my husband got a job with the Sunday Telegraph. And then while he was being fired on in Bosnia during that war, he was actually fired by the new editor, who was Charles Moore. Anyway, so we thought, right, what are we going to do? And it looked like back to Moscow again. That was in 1994. And this time around, we had a small child tagging along, and I wasn't sure I wanted to work that much, but I did some freelance work, economist and male, strange bedfellows, I know, but still. Having a Russian degree was actually quite a premium then, and everybody who came to Moscow needed your help because they couldn't even read the Cyrillic, you know. It was, help us, and it was wonderful feeling of power, you know. When John Timpson or Brian Redhead or anybody like that came out, we said, oh, we'll just drop you off at the metro. No, no, please take us back to the hotel. We won't find our way otherwise. We'll never get out of here. Anyway, very exciting because, of course, the first stretch in Moscow was under Gorbachev and then Yeltsin, and it was Yeltsin the second time around, so it's post-communist, very interesting. And it was at that point that I jumped ship. I went from journalism into the charity world. And it was pure chance, because I happened to be phoning up somebody in the Red Cross about a story that I wanted us to cover. I was working, as I say, freelance for the BBC then. And she said, no, don't call me tomorrow, call me, oh, next Tuesday. I said, hey, you've got a great job. How many days a week do you do? She said, three. I said, I want that job. And she said, as it happens, I'm just leaving. So it was all luck, you know. And I went and did that job. And of course, 3 days rapidly turned into 4 days, turned into 5 days. And I was an information delegate. And that was a kind of strange because I was aware that I became a little bit of a propagandist for the organization. It was the Federation, by the way. I see that you've had the ICRC upstairs. Well, you know, it's the sort of where siblings. But the Federation, as you probably know, handles the disasters, and the ICRC tackles conflict and prison visiting and so on. And ne'er the twain shall meet. But we did, actually, in Afghanistan. I had a trip to Afghanistan. But anyway, that was all well and good. Worked in Moscow. Then my husband got a job in Nairobi. So I said, great, Aid Hub. I can get a job there. Plenty going on there. And I thought, with my 3 years' experience in Moscow, this was a cinch. Not a bit of it, actually. It wasn't that easy, and we were worried about paying our electricity bills because they just cut you off. There's no red bill or anything like that, no final demand. I bet they do, and we were worried about water and all the rest. Anyway, landed in Nairobi from Moscow, minus 30 to plus 30. Two Russian cats, our Russian hats and everything. And I did actually work for the World Food Programme on a brief basis, as on maternity leave, in fact, somebody had to maternity leave. And then I went back into the Red Cross, because I love the Red Cross, for 3 years as a regional information delegate. That meant traveling all over that East Africa, Sudan, all over, and I learned a hell of a lot, frankly. And then I was offered a job by the World Food Programme in Rome. And you don't turn down Rome. That's the headquarters. Bit of a snake pit, but every headquarters tends to be. And I was out of the field, which Chris was talking about, and back into office. And that kind of suits some people and not others. Anyway, after 6 years in headquarters, I was then asked to come and head up the office here in London, where I am essentially responsible for talking about what a wonderful organization WFP is. Forget about all these NGOs, because we don't have many people talking about WFP. We don't spend money on people like me. We talk about every pound that you give to WFP, 93 pence goes to the beneficiary. We're very proud of our low overheads. But that also means the downside of that is we're not very well known, even though we're the biggest humanitarian organization. And we feed 100 million people around the world, but that's only a tenth of the hungry. It's a billion who are hungry. And now with the high food prices, we are really in the news. And that's great for me. Higher food prices, yes. And I think I probably shot my bolt, but I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
That's brilliant, Amy. Thank you very much indeed. Right, Carol.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Carol Pearson, and just want to say thank you for having me here today to speak. I like to think of my career really as a series of happy accidents, and I think it's true that a lot of people's careers, they don't work out how you think it's going to. So I read English at Hartford in the early 1990s, and I planned on becoming a journalist. And I did some work in the media whilst I was an undergraduate and really discovered that it wasn't for me. So I started down the career path of becoming a lawyer and didn't get funding. So I ended up on the dole, basically, when I graduated for a couple of months. So it was 93. We were in recession then, and times were hard. And I realised quite quickly that what I needed to equip myself with was some broad business experience. And so I ended up training to be an accountant, which is a well-trodden path. I started my career at Ernst & Young. When I joined, there were three other people from my college in the same intake. So it was definitely quite a well-trodden path. And I spent 5 years at Ernst & Young, where I qualified as a chartered accountant and had a really good broad range of business experience and an introduction to many different clients. And working for a big firm, you know, I now work for quite a small company, you realise that, you know, things work differently. In a small company, it's much more hands-on. Anyway, 5 years in, I'd been working on CDC as my client for a couple of years. And the finance director said, you know, how about coming to work for us, which was fantastic. So, you know, and I've been at CDC now for over 12 years and have quite a broad range of roles within that, but always within the finance side. But actually, within my team, I've always had people that have moved out onto the investment side. I don't actually know how many people have heard of CDC. Has anyone heard of CDC before? Okay, a few people, but we're actually quite a small organisation funded by the Department for International Development, where we invest in the low-income countries of the world with the aim of promoting development. So good economic development is seen to be good development. It encourages private sector investment, and it promotes employment and means that taxes are paid locally, and hence the funding helps within the local economy. So that's our aim. And my role is London-based, so I don't travel. Occasionally I go to see the investments. Within the 12 years that I've been there, you know, we've restructured quite a bit. We used to do a lot more direct investments, putting managers in countries to actually run the businesses that we were funding. And now we invest mainly by fund vehicles. So we put the money with a fund manager and they find the investments. And this attracts a lot of other people. There are sister organisations to us across Europe, in most of the European countries, and we do work with them as well, and obviously quite closely with DFID. We are actually undergoing quite a major restructuring at the moment and have been in the press quite a bit, unfortunately in some cases in private eye. But it is quite an interesting time as we look to do more different, possibly different instruments, so it'll be a very interesting time. As I was thinking of what sort of advice I would give to you, I would just try and get as much experience as possible. The hardest thing is getting your first role when you leave university. But if you've got a bit of work experience, or, you know, an internship, or anything like that, if you can do some, you know, volunteer work with charities, just to get some experience, to find out whether international development is for you. Because you don't necessarily know what will make you happy in your career. I know I certainly didn't. I thought the media was for me, but actually found it, you know, quite tough. I actually really enjoy being an accountant. I enjoy the analytical side. I actually use my degree, in my English degree, a lot more than I would have expected to. And it's about having the intellectual capabilities, I think. So it doesn't actually matter what degree you've got in many cases. And the other thing I would say is just do something that you're passionate about, that's going to sustain you, because we're working for a long time and it's going to be longer. You know, we're going to be working a long time. So do something that you care about. And that is what is great about international development, and a lot of people are passionate, so hence it is very competitive. But, you know, write to companies. I'm always interested. If letters come across my desk, you know, we do look at people for work experience. We had someone on the internship program last year, and we really do try and promote training people for the future, because, you know, you are the workforce of the future. So really just try and to differentiate yourself in that way, and don't be afraid of taking risks. You know, if the job isn't what you expected it to be, then, you know, that's life. A lot of people have been there before, and it's okay to change, and just to find out as much as possible about what's going to make you happy, because actually that's what matters at the end of the day.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for those really super tips of getting into the sector.
Hazel. Hello. Well, I'm afraid going to support what my colleagues have already said. I mean, when you go to school and university and whatever, they say to you, you know, you must have a career plan, you must have a goal. I don't think I ever have. And if I have, I forgot what it was and I never followed it. I started my university career at University College London and hated it with a passion. I was doing a geography and economics degree, and I could quite cheerfully have swung for two or three of the main lecturers. So I left, much to my parents' upset, and hung around for a bit working for a journalist who researched on African affairs. And my job was buying the cider, reading 10 or 12 newspapers a day in three or four languages, and cutting out anything that mentioned Africa and putting it in a file that we never looked at again. And that went on for a while. It was great fun. She was a very, very good journalist, very well regarded. I met most of the Zimbabwean and South African dissidents at that time. I met the Todds, and I met a man who had the lovely name of the Reverend Canaan Banana. Some wonderful people. And then I thought I really ought to start to grow up and do a job. So a friend of mine was doing a course she really liked in adventure play leadership. So I went and did that course, and then was a play leader for a while. And I thought, I can't stand adolescent boys gobbing anymore. So I had to leave that. And then I thought somebody mentioned couriering or coaching or something. I thought I'd drive a coach around Europe for a couple of years. And so I went and worked for London Transport and learned to drive a double-decker bus. That was fun. I was the second woman they ever took on, and I failed my test because they said I wasn't aggressive enough, which has made many people who've driven with me since laugh like drains. So then I didn't drive a bus, but I worked as a conductor for a while. And at the time I had a boyfriend who was a rather posh barrister, and he used to like to take me to parties, and he'd say, darling, I'll just leave you with Peregrine here, and just have a chat with him while I go and get you a drink. And Peregrine would say, oh, hello, and what do you do for a living? And I'd say, oh, I'm a bus conductor. And Peregrine would take two steps backwards, usually into a wall, and say, gosh, I'd better go and get a drink too. So we had fun with that. And then what did I do? Then I went into human resources, which is where I've stayed ever since. And I did worked with several organisations, including the Girl Guides and the Post Office Pension Fund, which was, at that time, the largest UK investor on the stock market. What else did I do? Oh, then I went to Oxfam. That's right, I did too. I went to be HR director for Oxfam and worked with them in the late 80s and very early 90s. Loved it and hated it. Loved the work, as you said. You know, they really are poison pits headquarters, really. So best, the further out you can get, the better. The best piece of Oxfam I ever went to was in Mozambique, and I was not at the main office, not at the sub office, but the little office at the top of 1,000 miles away. And what's more, the president commandeered my plane, so I had to stay swimming in the warm Pacific Ocean for 2 or 3 days because I couldn't fly back to where I was supposed to be because the president had taken my plane because his had broken. And I think there were 3 planes in the Mozambique British Airways, which will no longer exist. Fleet, that's the word. So, and since then, I then went and I did a master's in organisation development. Not having a degree, I quite like doing that. and worked as a consultant, and I'm now working for an organisation called Oxford HR, which recruits senior people for the development sector and the widest range of development sector, you know, health, education. Pardon?
Does it put them in headquarter buildings?
No. Most not. I mean, at the moment, we're looking for someone to work in Mozambique, someone to work in Zambia, someone to work in Uganda, in Kampala, someone to work in, you know, those things. So I also, therefore, know a bit about how other people get into development, and many of them have as varied a story as the four of us up here. People who have worked all their life in the commercial sector, made a fortune or at least got by very nicely, thank you, and then think, now the kids have left school and I don't have to pay their college fees anymore, I'm going to put something back, can I get into development? So often they've done some work to get them an idea of what development's like, and then they come across at a sort of director-to-director level. Particularly people do that into fair trade and and trading bits of organisation. You know, Oxfam has a big trading arm and most of the others do. But people come in at all sorts of levels. People who are journalists come in as communications people in the sector. So all of those things. Anyway, good. Let's
thank
talk.
You, Hazel. What an amazing array of insights and experiences. So thank you all very, very much.